Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 26th, 2005. Today's presentation, The Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Liberia, presented by Lima Bowie in the Creekside Room, disc number GBL-2005-02. Let's listen in.
Deep emotional wounds, helping to heal the deep emotional wounds. Some of the key elements of reconciliation, I have written it up here: acknowledgement, genuine expression of remorse, asking for or granting pardon, remedying the consequences of the harm, defining mutually beneficial relationship that addresses the root cause of the conflict. So these are all key elements to the word reconciliation. And in order for reconciliation to take place, some of these or all of these must happen. You know, it is both ways. And in our practical work, when we're doing practical work at the community level, we tend, most of the time, I love to give this illustration of reconciliation. As always say, this here is the mountain of peace. And up here you have wealth, you have health, you have everything. And this is the valley of misery. And once two persons have gone through conflict, you always find yourself down here in this valley of misery. Even if you are rich, you are always miserable. Because there's something that happened to you emotionally, there's something that happened to you physically, especially after going through real hurtful and destructive conflict. And if someone, as in the case of a civil war, or individuals have caused you such great pain, we always want to look at it as you and this person being tied together. Whether you know it or not, psychologically you are tied together. Have you ever been in conflict with anyone and every time you see that person, your heart misses a beat? Have you ever experienced that? That's the psychological joining of two individuals that have been in conflict. Real destructive conflict. I'm not just saying in a hall shouting at each other. I mean something that was really deep-seated. And because you are psychologically tied to this person, it is impossible for you to move on in life unless you have broken that tie. Especially for us who have gone through severe civil conflict, the hurt is so deep-rooted. It's so deep in there that you are tied to this person and you are always waiting for your day of reckoning. So because of that, you take all of your energy, all of your resources, and all of your time for revenge and paying back. So you can never really experience this mountain of peace in your life, no matter how much wealth or health you've acquired. And in order for you to really claim this mountain, there must be a disconnect between you and this person. You can never progress. I mean, if we had, I don't know who would give us a cord, so that a hair tie or something, so that we just illustrate here. But being tied to this person, and you are climbing this hill, and you are eager to reach up here, and this person is tired, and they want to sit down, they are going to impede your progress. There is no way you will progress once this person continues to sit. And as soon as this person sits, and then you sit, and then you are comfortable, the person gets up and wants to go on, you are sitting, they cannot move on. So your life becomes very difficult. Reconciliation is a two-way street. If this person who hurt you is refusing to acknowledge, is refusing to have this genuine expression of remorse, you can take this step by granting pardon. And if you sincerely grant that pardon, you are disconnected from this person. But what is the fate of the person? They have this big chain ball of guilt that they are carrying now, and you are free to progress in life. Let's take it the other way. This person acknowledges their guilt. They have this genuine expression of remorse, and they ask you for pardon. And you are defiant, and you are so hurt, I will not grant you pardon. What happens? This person is free, and you, the victim, are now left with this big chain ball of guilt, of hurt, of anger, of pain that you have to carry along for the rest of your life. Then you turn and see from down in your valley of misery, this person has climbed up to their mountain of peace and they are progressing in life. And then your anger is now directed at God. I am the victim here. Why am I not experiencing peace? Why am I not experiencing all of the, you know, the peace that comes with living? It's because you have refused to let go. And we see this happening more and more in our communities. On a day-to-day basis, it happens. People still go around with this deep-seated hate. There are some ethnic groups who refuse to let go in Liberia. For them, letting go means you've lost. For them, reconciling means they are the loser of the war. So every time they are looking for opportunities so that they have the upper hand. During this political season, unfortunately, my brother-in-law is from one of these ethnic groups, my cousin's husband, but we say brother and sister. There is no thing as cousins. And we were talking, and he said, our ethnic group, I said, well, I heard your ethnic group had a big conference in Minneapolis. He said, yes. I said, and what was the conference about? Even though I knew why they went to that conference, he said, well, we went to form political alliance. I said, really? He said, yes. We have decided as an ethnic group that we are going to go with this presidential aspirant who is a nephew of the former President Tubman and who worked with the UN all along. We feel that this is the only person that can guarantee our safety and protection after elections. And then I said to him, this is wrong. Because you've made this political party into an ethnic group. And I don't think this was the mindset of this guy when he left his job in Rwanda to come back to Liberia to run as president. He didn't want an ethnic political party. And I said, you know one thing? He said, no. I said, you don't have to be a political analyst to know that he's going to lose election miserably. He said, why? I said, because your ethnic group is one of the most hated ethnic groups in Liberia. And that you are forming political alliance based on your ethnicity, he's a loser. No one would want to go with him. And then he said, well, anyway, we're going to see, but this is the person, and they are publicly declaring that we feel safe and secure with this person as president of Liberia. After you've committed all of the atrocities from 1980 to 1990, now you are looking for safety instead of looking for reconciliation. So what is the TRC after we've gone through this quick thing in peace building? Stop me if you have any questions or comments. The TRC, for now, our constitution is the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which we call the CPA. The CPA is the one guiding the progress and the status of Liberia for the next 2 years, until January 2006, after inauguration. And the CPA states in Article 28 or 16, Part 6 of the CPA, it states that, and I'll read it directly, in the spirit of national healing and reconciliation, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is to deal with the root causes of all of the crises in Liberia, including human rights violation. Mandate: provide a forum that will address issues of impunity as well as an opportunity for both victims and perpetrators of human rights violation to share experiences in order to get a clear picture of the past to facilitate genuine healing and reconciliation. Secondly, to recommend measures to be taken for rehabilitation of both victims and perpetrators of human rights violation. So this is the act establishing the mandate of the purpose of the TRC and two mandates for us to carry out. But what we've seen is, since we've been given this mandate, it's been almost 2 years since the TRC was established, August 2003, up until today. The TRC bill was just passed in June 2004. Why? Because many of the members of parliament are former faction leaders and former warlords and former killers and former rapists and former everything. One of them said during the hearings to pass the act establishing the TRC, he said, the passage of the bill is like putting a noose around my neck for future hanging. So I'm going to do everything in my will and power to ensure that it's not passed. Because right now, there is amnesty. Blanket amnesty was given as part of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement for all acts committed during actual combat. Anything outside of combat, you can be prosecuted for. So one of the things that we will be looking at, and we've ensured as Women of Liberia that rape is specifically stated in that TRC bill as a crime against humanity. So if any woman can come and point at this person and say, he is the one who was responsible for X, Y, Z that happened to me, that person will also be summoned to the TRC. But what is happening now is that we don't have a clear-cut slate like South Africa to say we will grant amnesty. Ours is just to recommend to the next government that is coming that after we've heard this, that, and the other, we think party X, Y, Z should face, or we think there should be reparations for victims of the crisis. After we passed the bill was passed, another issue arose. People in parliament decided the TRC was not a clear-cut representative of the Liberian people. So they needed for us to go back to vetting and to go back, and the vetting should not be done by Liberians. It should be done by ECOWAS, meaning the sub-regional organization, Economic Community of West African State. So the ECOWAS leaders should be the ones to do vetting. So right now, everything is at a standstill until we can be vetted, which is frustrating for people who really want to go out and tell their stories. What is the opportunities? Yeah. Okay, it's like you're going to be asked questions to see whether you're qualified to sit on a commission. So there should be a vetting committee. There are several opportunities, two that I've identified for the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Liberia. One, a war-weary population. Because of the tiredness, the war fatigue of the Liberian people, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has a very good opportunity to work. People are so tired, they want their stories to be told, both victims and perpetrators, especially young combatants who have been isolated from their communities. They feel the need to go and tell their stories that they were not the ones, but actually a lot of people are not looking at what they want, who kind of like coerced them into fighting. So they too want to tell their stories. Victims want to tell their stories. In my work with the women, what we do most of the time is we have a cycle where we call shedding off the weight.
Oh, what?
Shedding off the weight. Oh,
okay.
And we kind of like model this after our traditional society called the Sunday Society. This is where only women go and tell their stories or do other things, even though now it has been blown out of proportion with this whole thing of female genital mutilation and all like that. But in the Sunday, women sit and talk real personal issues. And as part of the shedding off the weight, we go in a circle where we have candles that we light, and women, we take the candle one after the other, is passed on to you to tell your story. And I had worked with some of these women for like 2 years. And then one day, after we've done disarmament and there were a lot of tears, I decided, okay, let's do 2 days of shedding off with these 25 who had gone into the camps to work with the combatants. And of those 25 women that came every day to build community peace with smiles on their face, little did I know that 18 of them had been brutally raped in 2003. And this is 2003 December that I'm talking about. So just earlier on in the year, I mean, some of the most cruel ways. Some of these women were
50, 60,
and they were gang raped. And for most of them, they walk around in the community looking at the young men who did this to them. And for them, they just don't want it to go like that, in as much as they don't want any punishment for them, but they want the story to be told. So that these young people can either acknowledge that, yes, I did this, and that I will not do it again. But there's a... So all of these problems that we're facing as part of the TRC is really frustrating people. But one opportunity is that we have a war-weary population. The second opportunity that we have, unlike Rwanda, who set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and couldn't move forward because one group was victorious. The Tutsis were the winners of the war. Liberia, there were no winners. We were all losers. So everyone wants to tell the story of how they lost the war. In countries where one group comes off victorious, that group is always ensuring that there is no Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It was possible in South Africa because there were no winners. There was a stalemate. So in Liberia, that's one of the biggest opportunities that we have, that no one won the war. But also there are challenges that we are currently going through. I talked about this whole thing of vetting. The second one is, when a TRC process, the process should be a company. It should be, it's a journey. Reconciliation, I would like to refer it as a, to it as a journey. Some people refer to it as a method. Other people refer to it as a, as the result of a particular work that you carry on. But I see it as a journey. And in order to carry on this journey, it takes commitment from outside people and it takes resources. But if you have a TRC that has a mandate, 2 years, your work should be done in 2 years. That's where you see a lot of frustration. We've just seen the case of Sierra Leone. 2 years, bam. 2 years afterwards, the commission was saying, we still need time. And then they gave them 6 months because that's all the donors who afford. So if you have a long-term commitment and long-term resources, even though the process cannot be endless, you know, but there should be at least a bit of time given for this work to be done. The second challenge is combining justice with reconciliation. The victims' biggest quest as they come to the TRC is because of this word justice. The perpetrators or the offenders, their biggest quest as they come is this word, forgiveness or amnesty. In South Africa, as soon as the word amnesty was said, a lot of the perpetrators came out because they were giving amnesty. So they could even stand and made lightly of some of the things that they did to people because they knew afterwards nothing would happen to them. Justice also could be viewed as it relates to the offenders as punishment. So because of that, there could be a resistance to the entire process of TRC. In Sierra Leone, it was very difficult for people to come up. The fighters were not coming up. Community members were not coming up. Because the community members' own was that there wasn't anything said about reparation for them. Nothing about restitution. So why are we going there? Combatants were afraid if we go, we'll be punished. Community members will finally know who did X, Y, and Z, and they will come after us. So for a long period, there was this calling and polling until this word, amnesty, came out. The other thing is, as it relates to justice, is that in as much as we talk about reparation and everything, one thing people need to look at especially those who are facilitating. This is something that we, in our discussion as commissioners, we are always talking about. In order for the TRC to be effective, you must realize that some of the issues that really caused the war, some of the root causes of war, had to do with institutional policies and practices. So how do we ensure that there are changes in the institutional policies and practices? How do we ensure that there is a clear demarcation line between the three branches of government, that the executive branch is not lording over the judiciary and the legislative branch of government? Few days ago, we were in New York, and there was a panel on Africa, and we had one ambassador talk to us, this African who had done great studies about Africa and some of the problems. And one of the things he said was that until we get to the point where our partners in the North and in European countries, North America and in European countries, reach to the point where they see this whole thing as a partnership, that's the only way we'll move forward. That's the only way we'll end some of the saber wars that we have. Because you have governments who have been there forever. She shared an article with me and wanted to know my impression. There is this journalist from Cameroon who wrote and was translated in the New Yorker, where he said Africans know their problems. And he was really lashing out at musicians that went out during the G8 summit to organize concerts for poverty in Africa. He said they should not be organizing concerts, but rather they should be mobilizing and advocating for some of the change in the structures in Africa. Africa is very rich. If there were changes in the structure, there would be no need for them to do concert to feed hungry people in Africa. While I agree with his theory, I think he was a bit too hard on these musicians who, for all they were trying to do, was to ensure that food is placed on the table of some hungry African child. At the G8 this year, maybe a lot of you don't know this, what the G8 nations agreed to do, one, was to forgive the debts of 18 of the poorest nations in Africa. Two, they were committed again to training 20,000 peacekeeping troops for different peacekeeping missions in Africa. And then they said in 2010, they will make universal access to HIV and AIDS drugs. Even though scholars and academias want to believe that now they have the resources to provide the universal access to HIV and AIDS drugs, but they are still holding on and saying in 2010. Meanwhile, as we speak, every 10 minutes, 60 persons die in Africa from HIV and AIDS. Every 10 minutes. So if you do the calculation, you will know that in 5 years, how many of the Africans will be gone, as while the G8 nations still discuss issues of HIV drugs and other things.
How many is it that die every 10 minutes?
60. So these are some of the discussion changes in structures and policies and issues. And sometimes it's difficult for this change because some of the governments continue to, the policies that come from outside is benefiting both the leaders and their donors. So instead of fighting corruption, they are condoning corruption. For example, in this tiny country of West Africa, Togo, Iyadima led for over 20-something years. He died a few months ago. As soon as he died, the military instated his son as president of Togo. People revolted. They went in the street. They removed him and put a transitional government. They did not address some of those structural things. 3 months later, they had elections. His son won the election. Elections monitors from around the world declared the election's result as free and fair. So in this guy's article, these were some of the issues that he was raising, So as part of any truth commission, in order to look at the whole issue of justice and forgiveness, victims and offenders, we also need to look at some of the structural problems, some of the structural changes that we need. And so far, since we've been looking at our political candidates in Liberia, there's just one candidate who had ever talked about the clear division of power between the executive, legislative, and judiciary. And someone said to me, if I was a Liberian, that is the person I'll be going for. Because once you have a functional three branches of government, every other thing will fall in place. The hungry will be fed, the sick will be given medication, because there is not one branch of government that will be lording over the other. The final challenge that we have is the challenge, the whole challenge of reparation. Like I said earlier, there's nothing said about what will be given to victims in exchange for their stories. And I was saying to someone earlier, that's one of the stories of the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission that the media doesn't carry. The cries of the people that went out and told their story. In April, we're in South Africa, and we had the opportunity of going to Cape Town, Soweto. And one woman said to us, I feel hurt. I feel betrayed by Mandela, by Mbeki, and by the whole ANC. That they came and we told our story. But since we told our story, nothing has been done to address it in terms of restitution or reparation. People were given, again, the offenders were victorious. They were given blanket amnesty. Some of us sat there and told our stories and were violated again just by the memory of the stories that we told. And nothing has happened. So reparation is a big thing, especially as it relates to TRC processes. And one of the things that in my conversation with one of the Chief Justices of Liberia once, I said to him, Counselor, if we could really ensure that whoever takes over, look at this whole issue of restorative justice. For example, if someone went into a village and committed a massacre, and maybe an older person is still alive in that village, that person should be responsible to going back to that village and helping to make farm for that person. Because if that person's husband was alive, he would be making a farm. If that son of hers was alive, he would be making a farm. So that is a way of saying to people that I'm sorry and I want to make amends for what I did. So this is a big conversation as it relates to reparation in the TRC process. And I would just like to end with the words of Martin Luther King. I think this is the word for all of us, as conflict will always be a part of our communities. He says, unless we learn to live together as brothers and sisters, we will all perish like fools. Unless we learn to live together as brothers and sisters, black or white, Hispanic, free, slave, whatever, we will all perish like fools. I'll take questions now.
Yes, sir.
What different ways, besides going into a community to help, are reparations manifest? Money? How else, what other ways can reparations be achieved?
Sometimes in simple ways that, for example, money is not a big issue, especially in villages. What will an old woman do with money? Maybe she's still struggling with rebuilding her home. And this combatant who was responsible for breaking down that home goes back into the community with resources from the government and say to this woman, I'll help you rebuild your home. You've done so much more than giving her $1,000. Because sometimes it's very important for that exchange between victims and offenders. Once it's not there, that whole thing is just cosmetic. It is still something that I'm still trying to get a grip of. And you should not be surprised if you heard I resigned my position as member of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, because I would never want to be a part of anything that is just a formality and that it doesn't address true healing of people who've been, you know, both the young people, we have 90,000 ex-combatants. Some of them were conscripted into armed faction at the age of 8. Some of them at the age of 7. And they committed some of the worst atrocities in their communities. But do you call these little children offenders? They are also victims, in my own word. So I would want to see someone like Taylor, who established a small boys unit, take half of his wealth and put it into rebuilding an institution where these young people can go and do long-term rehabilitation. That would be reparation for the society. For me, that is, not just going and doing this thing, and people come in, you all cry together, and at the end of the day, nothing. Any other question?
You spoke yesterday about the ethnicity that's divided Liberia into so many groups. Is that one of the main obstacles to reparation?
Yes. The group that I spoke about earlier on that talked about this one political candidate as the person, they are from southeastern Liberia. Our former president, Doe, that's his ethnic group. During the Doe era, and when we look at another challenge, maybe my eyes skipped that. Another challenge of the TRC process is the whole definition of who is a victim and who is an offender. Because for 15 years, here we have the American Liberians. Those were the free slaves. From 1820 up until 1980, they have oppressive and suppressive rules. From 1980 to 1990, the indigenous people came back and paid back. From 1997 to 2003, because Charles Taylor is a descendant of American Liberians, the American Liberians again took over. And so who can we really say in this whole chain is a victim? Who is an offender? As a matter of fact, when we started the discussion with civil society groups and organizations, some people wanted the TRC mandate to start from as far back as 1820. You know, every TRC should have a cutoff point. At the end of the day, the cutoff point is 1980. Now, the Crown ethnic group that took over in 1980 are contending what happened to issues that led to our coming in 1980. And this was some of the discussion we had on the parliament floor the day we went for some, the hearing, for some of the days that we went for the hearing. So ethnicity is really playing a key role. And that is the reason why I'm carefully stepping into the process of the TRC. A few days ago, I said to my partner, I think I want to resign. And then he said to me, I think you should hold on a bit. But you know, because it's really something that will undo all of the work that I've done in the last 4 or 5 years. Because if that process is not carried out carefully, you stand to be named as one of those who damned or condemned our ethnic group as being the people responsible for the war. So it's really crucial. And the American Liberians are glad that 1980 is the cutoff point. Because that's when they feel they were offended. Their duly elected son was killed. But what happened to all of those years where the indigenous people land were taken and other things happened to them? So this is the kind of, you know, ethnic clashes that we're having even now as we're starting to establish.
How does the ethnicity maintain? Language, culture?
Language and culture. But then the sad thing is, a lot of these ethnic groups that live close by have joking relationships. Meaning, if you are lawman, that's another ethnic group, I'm Pele, you are my nephew. And there is a traditional pact that was signed years ago between these two ethnic groups that I cannot raise my hand against my nephew, and my nephew cannot raise his hands against me. The Crowns and the Gills, those are one of the two contending ethnic groups. The Gills originally were the warriors, whereas the Crowns were the juju, had all of the juju power. So when the Gills, because they live so close by, and most often they wage war on Avoren bordering town, when the Gills got ready to go to war, the Crowns would prepare the herbs, to ensure that they came back victorious. As part of the traditional pact, they were not to raise hands against each other. But as of 1980, a lot of crime geo-killing went on. We went into a consultation with the ethnic leaders, the elders and Zoos, traditional leaders, and they said we need to kill a cow and share a big meal and wash our hands together so that the blood that we've wasted, that water can wash it off the land. As soon as this was said, politicians exploited the situation. Instead of allowing it to really take the true traditional meaning, they went in there with big festivals so that they could be seen. And I kept saying to someone, this is going to blow out of proportion. And they said, oh, it's going to work. 2 days after the meal was shared, the Crown group for the first time left their village and went and slaughtered thousands, hundreds of geese. Then everyone sat down and said, what happened to the reconciliation that was widely publicized? So you have all of these. And the intention, I think, was to maintain peace. But sometimes it's exploited. Okay, I'll take from Mark, take from you, and take from Suzanne.
It sounds like, you know, as I know the South African situation, part of the power of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was not simply dealing with the atrocities and the memories, but building a future together.
Yeah.
And it seems like what you're saying is that the memory issue is so strong, so difficult, and so problematic, that the question of a future is still very difficult to look at in Liberia. Where do you see some hope there? Or something that's calling people simply, not beyond the hurt that they feel, but in addition to dealing with memory and pain, looking to a new, building a new nation?
Well, I think the hope, I'm one person who's optimistic. I'm very optimistic, and that's the reason why I stay in Liberia up to this point. And sometimes I would like to see the hope in religious institution, meaning people of faith. There are some people of faith who are really eager to go out there to try to build a future. But I just want to take you back to the South African one. In as much as they had a TRC that the world celebrated, if you went to South Africa today, you still feel it. It's still there. Apartheid is still alive. The wealth is in the hands of one group of people. One of my girlfriends said to me when we were going to Soweto, I am not going to that place. I always leave from there depressed. Strangely, when I came back, everyone asked me, how do you feel? I said, I feel energized to continue the work that I do. And they said to me, you're a weird person. I said, yes, because going and reading and seeing the suffering of a group of people makes me to want to work for peace more and more so that my own people do not go through what these people are continuing to go through. The blacks in South Africa have sunk into a thing of, they are just there. And just existing on a day-to-day basis. Mm-hmm. It is still there. It is still. So somebody said there's a need for us to keep an eye on South Africa because it could turn out to be another Zimbabwe. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, now Thabo Mbeki is called Mumbeki. Mm-hmm. What's the Zimbabwean president name? But the Mbeki is because of the Zimbabwean president. And they're saying that Mbeki would probably start to institute some of the policies of the Zimbabwean guy. People are looking at in 10 or 15 years, probably issues of land reform. You know? So then what would have happened to this beautiful, highly celebrated Truth and Reconciliation Commission? Nelson Mandela is still an icon of peace building. What happens after he died? Because he still has his hand in a lot of the stability that South Africa is experiencing. So coming back to our own situation, that's why if we have to really go through a process of healing and reconciliation, we need to be very careful. And I think the outcome of the October 11th election in Liberia, the future of Liberia depends highly on it. Say, for example, this guy who is being supported by the crowns wins the elections. The Gios are going back into the forest to start a new rebel incursion, because that would be a no-no thing for them. Say, for example, someone from the Mandingo ethnic group wins the election. The crowns and the Gios are going back. Or the Christians will stand up and say, no way. Our country was founded on Christian principles, and there is no way a Muslim will lead us. So that hope of all of the work that is being done will be established if we have a leader who has true reconciliation at heart and who want to be looking at institutionalizing the whole process of reconciliation, not making it a cosmetic thing.
Is there a candidate that will do that?
It's difficult to say because people come with beautiful platforms. You know, and at the end of the day, they just go completely. My grandmother has a very beautiful illustration of aspirants of presidential candidates. She said when they are moving around and looking for your votes, they ride the pickup back, the back of a pickup truck, and they will wave. And as soon as they are declared winner, they go into the limousine with dark glass. They don't want to see the people that voted for them again. You know?
Yeah.
I'm sure when some of the campaigns were happening, you had the opportunity of shaking hands. But when they win the elections, the CIA and FBIs are like this. You can't come near. It's the same situation back home. So now, sometimes we just see platforms and all of these things as rhetorics, you know? I will take from her, and then you.
Has the UN been a help or a hindrance to, you mentioned the UN yesterday.
Well, in this whole TRC process, the UN has been a hindrance from the world go. As a matter of fact, we think they are the ones who are influencing some other civil society organizations to go after this whole thing of vetting. Initially, when the TRC started, the UN went to Switzerland, and that's where they wrote the act establishing the Liberian TRC. So when that act was brought to town, people resisted. Said, this is a Liberian thing. It should be done the Liberian way. We'll not allow it to happen the way it happened in Sierra Leone. So afterwards, everything now has been, as a matter of fact, even the Elections Commission, is because we have a very strong group of commissioners. That's why the Elections Commission is still standing and still talking, or else the UN wanted it their way or no other way. And then the problem in Liberia is so difficult because there's so much politics with the whole peace agreement. The peace was instituted by the West African government. By the time there were headways that peace was in sight, the U.S. and the U.N. came and took over. There was this African from Chad who used to be the U.N. ambassador into Liberia prior to all of the wars. Then they removed him and put a U.S. former general. And then you had all of this problem of who is the chairman of the transitional government loyal to. One minute he's dancing to the tune of the U.S. and the U.N., the next meeting, the ECOWAS presidents are calling him to a meeting and telling him, hey, we put you there. It's either you do what we say. And so it's difficult on the people. They don't really know who to believe. The EU, for example, came up and said, Liberia is the transitional government is as corrupt can be. The US ambassador said, this government is doing so well. So who do we believe? Of course, because of our strong ties to the U.S., we say, hey, Ambassador Blinney is saying the right thing. So people now want to believe that the U.S. actually has a candidate that they support. Now they go into the news and say, no, we don't have any candidate that we are supporting. We don't have, you know. But people want to still believe that's not true.
Are you creating a Truth and Reconciliation Commission on another model? It sounds like South Africa really isn't the model you're using. Has it worked somewhere that you're looking at, or are you starting new?
The sad thing is, since the South African one, every other African one that came into existence failed miserably. Mm-hmm. You would think that they would look at all of the mistakes made in South Africa and make corrections. If we go back to history, South Africa is still the best. So honestly, I don't see any future for ours being better than the South African one. Every other one has been a failure. Sierra Leone was a complete failure. As a matter of fact, people don't want to talk about it.
Is there any structure in place to assure that the elections will be fair and perceived as fair?
Yes, they are trying. Right now, I think the Church World Service is trying to put together a group of Christians from the US and Europe to go in to monitor. But I think they're still going through some of the logistical details. The UN still have their 15,000 peacekeeping troops on the ground. And right now, because we don't have anyone with any strong military power like President Taylor had in 1997, that's why he won the elections, people think more or less it's going to be a level playing field. But the thing is, this election is going to be called by money. The candidates with the biggest money will probably win. Because people are so impoverished that they will do anything for money. So if someone went, like some candidates are now going to communities and building something as cheap as pit latrine for people who never had anything like that. I know just before I came, my entire community never had safe drinking water. And this big corporate lawyer came in and built hand pump for safe drinking water. And my grandmother came to me that morning and said, I'm voting for that guy. So I said, she said, who are you voting for? I said, I don't know. She said, excuse the expression, don't be an ass. You better vote for that man who gave us drinking water in this community. Mm. And I'm like, ma, a few days ago, you didn't know. She said, yes, my child. But we've been suffering for drinking water for so long. Uh-huh. And I'm voting for him. And that's a clear-cut thing. And then you see most of the older ladies in my community now saying, this is our candidate. Mm. As a matter of fact, they were planning to have a cultural performance for this guy. But this is the way, and this big corporate lawyer also is the one who owns a vast land and internally displaced people have been living on that land for free for the last 6-7 years. A few days ago, they had a big program where they called him to tell him thank you for giving them his property for free. And this big corporate lawyer is the lawyer of all of the American holdings in Liberia. He has all of the money. But he is, according to a lot of people from a very simple background, doesn't let people in on his wealth. He doesn't show it off. Lives simply, still eats at his mother's place. His mother is a typical indigenous person, except that he's Harvard trained and was top of his class when he graduated. And rumors have it that he was at Bush inauguration. We don't know. Anyway, so that's where we are. Any other question or comment? Yes?
You talked about some of the problems with blanket amnesty and yet some of the need for amnesty in terms of getting offenders to come forward. Can you talk a little bit about how, what degrees of amnesty might make sense?
Okay, within the building, the act establishing the TRC is clearly stated that any violation seen as a violation of the international human rights law doesn't apply to it. Any violation, any act committed that within the international criminal code is punishable, no amnesty can be granted. So it is clearly stated there. Rape, like I said, now at the International Criminal Court is punishable. So,
what kind of acts are not punishable in the international court?
That's a very good question. Well, maybe burning down homes, you know, where everyone was put out of their house and the house was burned down. It's something that you can be given blanket amnesty for. Or someone 8 years old coming and executing an entire family. That person will not go to international court. Whoever issued That order is the person who's going to the international court. So these young people will be placed into rehabilitation, something that is very difficult. Because after DDR, in the disarmament process, that's what we call DDR. After that, in April, May, June, UNICEF had 250 young fighters, and their communities were saying they are not coming back here. 11, 12 years old, 13, 14, 15. Their parents were saying, no, 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 you can have them, take them to any country in the world, but we don't want to have anything to do with them. So these young children are in shelters now, and they are street children. Most of them, you find them on the streets. If you're parking your car, they come to you and say, please, can I stand by your car and you give me something to eat afterwards? You know, that's the kind of thing they do. But don't make a mistake to leave your car open. You'll steal everything in there. Yes, sir.
Is there a kind of individual healing from telling one story that doesn't require institutional change? What I'm thinking about is, in that Desmond Tutu, No Future Without Forgiveness, talking about that, he suggests that happens.
Yeah.
The woman who tells the story, you did this to my husband and my children, and you acknowledge my pain, at least I know I exist. Mm-hmm. Is that
yes.
healthy?
And in this shedding off the weight that we talk about, one of the reasons why we do shedding off the weight is that people have been going around. I saw it in my own mother. I saw it in myself. For years, carrying the pain and the agony of the crisis. And all they need, especially women, is just someone to listen to their story. Because everyone else is coming to them with their stories, but they don't have anywhere to let out. That's why it's very important, before we have any capacity building session in our peace building work at the community level, we take off one night, and most of the time when we enter the room at 6 p.m., we are up till 6 a.m. Mm-hmm. And the way we do it, we'll switch off all of the lights, sit around a bowl of water, and we've poured expensive perfume in that water that the fragrance is just all over the room. And as you tell your story, you have the candle, because that light, it means the light is on you now. And at the end of your story, if you feel a kind of release, you can get up and wash your hands in that water and say, whoever did this to me, I forgive them and I ask God to forgive me. That's our simple way of doing it. Some people say, I'm not ready to wash my hands yet, and we respect that. And other people, I went through similar thing. And when I told my story was told amongst women from different parts of West Africa. There was no dry eye in the room. Because we were at that meeting, and the kind of strength that they saw in me, no one knew. And I really didn't have any clue that I was that bad off until we sat in this room. We were doing a course in family life. And then there was a question that came up, the professor asked. And when I raised my hand, one of the guys made a simple joke. You shouldn't say anything because you don't know anything about family life. I almost killed him. I was so angry. Fortunately for me, the guy who was teaching that course was a priest. He took me aside and said to me, you need help. You really do need help. All along, I had seen myself as a very calm person. So I thought, I think it's time for me to tell my story. Because there were things about my life as a refugee that I never told any of my family members until that day. When I told that story, after I told the story, I felt comfortable. And one evening, I'm sitting with my elder sister. I said, Mommy, she said, yes. I said, do you know that once? Because my kids and I, after I left my husband, went to live on a camp. I said, do you know that once when we were on a camp, I was so hungry, I had to pick from people left over. My sister was crying. She said, Lema, as much as we went through the war, we never ate from dirt pile. You had to do that. And I said to her, yes. She said, but you are smiling. I said, because I'm really going through that. So you tell your story and you feel like something is lifted off your shoulder. My assistant is a young 28-year-old girl who is bustling with life. September last year, all of the time when we start this session, she was feeling, oh, I'm so tired, and go to bed. Because she didn't want to tell her story. But this day she said, I'll tell my story. It took her 2 hours. I didn't know that this beautiful young lady had gone through rape, forced to sleep with older men at the hands of her family members because they had to survive the war. Afterwards, she woke up and said to me, I feel good this morning. I have another friend who sat to tell her story and refused to cry, and she got sick. She said, I need that opportunity to tell my story again. Because I think, because every time as she told her story, when she came to the point of shedding tears, she would scream and then she would hold back. And for her, shedding the tears would have meant those who committed all of those acts against her had won. Because when she was being raped, she never cried. When she was being beaten, she never cried. Crying for her was a sign of weakness. So that day she was telling her story, she kept turning her hand and clinging to her chest and pulling on her entire body, but she never shed any tears. The next morning I saw her, I said, you look like mess. She said, I feel like mess. But she got sick. And until she told her story, she continued to feel that way. So sometimes it's just, let someone hear what you've gone through and show that they care. But we've had many women who've said, sorry. We had a session once, the first time we had this session, I will never forget. We were in a refugee camp, and these women sat in a room, 50 of them, and we were only 3 to listen to their stories. One after the other, one after the other, the pain, I cried, just said to them, stop! And I realized, I said, if it is too much for you all, let's close down for the day. I was expressing my emotions. Mm. And one of the older women stood up and said, when relief agencies come into this camp, they bring food. Church groups bring Bibles. Other people bring zinc sheets for us to rebuild our homes. You've brought the best thing, to listen to the stories from our bellies. That's the way of saying traditionally that this is something that touched me. She said, and if you could just sit and listen, you'll be doing us so much good than the food that is brought here. So we sat till 9, from 8 in the morning till 9 p.m., crying, holding each other's hands, because we understood the pains that each of us shared. And after those sessions, I don't look sophisticated. I always look like a complete mess. Because emotionally, I am drained. The last session I ever did this year, while I was doing that session, one of my friends who had died earlier, son got shot. And I was in the midst of that session. That evening when I went home, already drained from the stories that I heard, the children in my house said to me, you have to go to the hospital, because the boy was shot today while they were playing with a pistol that should have been taken to the disarmament camp. I went into that room and all I could see was his father sitting in the corner the same way he sat when my friend died. The bullet passed through here, came through the eye and came out. He's now here in the States and they're treating him. The next morning I went, I had to go back. Because I was the only one doing that session that day. One of my colleagues afterwards saw me and said, I think you need to take a holiday. You need to go to your kids. And I said, I think so too. And she said, because you look a complete mess. But the joy you feel afterwards, seeing these women celebrate that they've told their stories, 1 month, 2 months later, you go into the communities and those women that were shy are now standing in the midst of other women and raising traditional songs, and you are all dancing together and celebrating together. Some of them in the group, one other woman sat there and she just kept crying and crying and crying. And finally, and she was the one who mobilized all of her friends to come to the sharing of the weight session. And then she said, I have to see. And everyone turned and looked at her. She said, I was raped too. And all of the women in our community could not believe it, because she had guided that pain for so long. We have to end now, and I'll just read. I love this People Building Two-Piece book from Desmond Tutu. Wrote something in here that was his personal story. It says, a force more powerful. And this is the message that I would like to leave with you. Let us strive together to make our world peace-friendly. Let us make it a world where humanity can survive and flourish, and where justice flows like a river and tears are wiped away from eyes. For mourning and sorrow will be done away, and peace and love, compassion and caring and sharing, laughter and joy will prevail. Because we are learning to see with the eyes of the heart, realizing that we are all members of one family, God's family. Have a blessed day. Thank you.